Hello and welcome to the History of Singapore. Before today's episode, a small announcement. Following the broadcast of episode 49 of the History of Singapore on BFM 89.9 at 3 p.m. on the 7th of October 2016, I will be live on the radio to take questions and discuss season 1 of the History of Singapore. So if you have any questions, please listen in either on air or online at bfm.com.my and you'll have the opportunity to call or tweet your questions on Friday, 7th October at around 3:30 p.m. I look forward to hearing from you then. And now on with the show. Episode 48, The Chinese Ultra. Last week, we discussed how the endless political manoeuvring of 1961-64, and in particular the communal politicking originated by Lee Kuan Yew in 61 and brought to extremes by a small section of UMNO leaders in 1964, finally erupted into violence in Singapore, and was possibly also used by Indonesia to advance Konfrontasi. We don't know for sure because the findings of the Commission of Inquiry remain secret. But what we do know is that the conditions for the outbreak of violence were undoubtedly created by irresponsible politicians on both sides of the causeway who were seeking political gain. Thus, I want to stress that understanding the immediate reasons for the violence in Singapore in 1964 and early 65, in other words, what happened on the ground, whether it was caused deliberately or whether it was by accident, understanding these are not necessary for understanding the broader causes and therefore the consequences of the violence. Whatever happened on the ground would not have happened without the irresponsible politicians. And the response of the politicians in the PAP to the violence was to drastically change its strategy in Malaysia. Previously, it had still sought to displace the MCA and work with UMNO in the government of Malaysia. Because of this, it had largely remained silent as UMNO and its proxies and allies in Singapore ramped up their communal rhetoric following the April 1964 elections. It had provided no effective counter to UMNO's rhetoric, beyond trying to clarify and correct UMNO rhetoric, not just out of a desire to placate UMNO, but because a lot of what they were saying was actually true. The Malays were worse off in Singapore than other communities. The PAP couldn't deny facts. But the problem was that the PAP did not know how to effectively counter the communal politics of UMNO without also making an enemy of UMNO and dooming its own chances of joining the alliance government. After the riots, the PAP significantly changed course. They decided that the entire existing political system of communally based political parties was bankrupt. The whole idea of communal balances and power sharing between races was unworkable and would only lead to further disaster. They decided to go all in for a new political system, a multiracial Malaysia that transcended ethnicity, race, and religion. And this is the decision which sets us on the road to separation. But it was a long road, and there were many opportunities to turn off the road, to turn back. But they were not taken. When the July 1964 riots broke out in Singapore, the Tunku had been in London. While he was in London, Sir Alec Douglas Home, the British Prime Minister, urged the Tunku to form a coalition government with the PAP. You will remember last week when I pointed out that the inherent contradiction of Malaysia was that the Malaysian agreement specifically excluded Singapore from Malaysian politics. You can't have one country if there are two separate governments. National unity required a government that represented all Malaysians. You must have national political parties, which take time to build in a new country. And the British saw this contradiction. Also, they were heavily invested in Malaysia. They had expended significant political capital to create Malaysia. They saw Malaysia as a bulwark against communism in Southeast Asia, and the Singapore base was a key link in their defence strategy, which linked Britain with Australia and New Zealand. And of course, on top of it all, by 1964, the British were spending no less than £1 million a day on military spending against Konfrontasi. And they had ended national service in 1960, with the last national serviceman leaving service in May 1963. So unlike the Malaysian emergency, this was now an entire professional army that they were paying for, fighting far away from home, all funded by the British taxpayer. The British were heavily subsidizing Malaysian defense, and so they had a lever to use against the Tunku. On the 14th of August, the Tunku returned to Malaysia, where he addressed the crowd on the riots, and he broke down. A young Musa Hitam, who was in attendance, described how, quote, "with total sincerity and in the Malay words a father would use to admonish quarrelling children, the Tunku struck chords of deep emotion," unquote. Between sobs, the Tunku said, quote, "I have always reminded leaders to be careful when they speak and to be cautious in wording their speech so that disturbances will not occur among the people of the country," unquote. It was a masterful display of political theatre, which the Tunku repeated a few days later in Singapore. In attendance was Lee Kuan Yew, who observed firsthand the power of a leader weeping in front of his people. Lee was very impressed and declared he would, quote, "go to the end of the world," unquote, to help the Tunku solve the conflict. And he said, quote, "if there is one man who can resolve it, it is he," unquote. In a private meeting between them, the Tunku made clear he was very angry with Syed Jaafar Albar and would deal firmly with him. But at the same time, it would split his party to take the PAP into the federal cabinet at this time, and he again asked Lee to take the PAP out of federal politics and stay in Singapore. There is no doubt of the Tunku's good intentions, but even if the Tunku was inclined to compromise with Lee, his own party would not allow him to. Lee had become, in the minds of UMNO members, public enemy number one. His incisive speeches were just attacking UMNO policies. They were attacking the entire worldview of UMNO's Malay politicians in terms which UMNO's politicians saw as deeply, personally offensive. And so UMNO activists were firmly opposed to Lee. They saw him as a threat to Malaysia. As the Utusan Melayu wrote, quote, "Lee Kuan Yew wants to see bloodshed between the two friendly communities for his own political ends," unquote. And I believe that's how many in UMNO genuinely saw Lee. There could be no compromise with a man they saw as willing to murder his own people for political gain. On the 2nd of September 64, further riots broke out in Singapore. 13 dead, 106 injured, 1,439 people arrested. This time, they were probably instigated by Indonesian agents. As with last week, we don't really know because the documents remain classified. But again, it would not have happened without the inflammation of the situation by the politicians. This time, it was Lee who was in England. And on 13th September, the same day Lee returned to Singapore, the UK's Sunday Telegraph published an ill-informed but very scathing editorial attack on the Tunku and compared him to Sir Roy Walensky, who as Prime Minister of the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland opposed British moves towards black majority rule and violently suppressed political opposition. The Telegraph argued that British military aid should be made conditional on KL's willingness to, quote, "build a non-racial united community really worth saving," unquote. Now, this coincidence was just too much. The alliance leaders believed Lee had instigated the editorial while in London. The Tunku was, quote-unquote, "hopping mad." In a statement, he wrote, quote, "there is an undercurrent to contest my leadership of the Malaysian people by trying to make out that I am a leader of Malays only," unquote. To de-escalate the raging war of words, a meeting between the PAP and Alliance was held on the 29th of September. And following this meeting, which was between the Tunku, Razak, Tan Siew Sin, Lee Kuan Yew, Toh Chin Chye and Lim Kim San, Toh Chin Chye announced a 2-year truce was agreed upon. But in reality, the truce was merely an agreement to avoid provocative remarks for 3 months. The Tunku would restrain the Malay extremists and end the anti-PAP campaign. the PAP would stop expanding its organization in Malaysia. Of course, the truce was honored more in the breach than in the observance, but the level of verbal warfare was, for a short time, basically reduced to something approaching normal levels of politics. And it was around this time, October 1964, that rumors circulated that the island would secede from Malaysia. Politicians from both sides firmly condemned the idea of separation. But the very next month came the event that would end the truce and catalyze the process of separation. And as I mentioned back in episode 46, it was not race. It was not politics. It was money that eventually did it. Stay tuned. Tan Siew Sin, the Federation's finance minister, was facing a massive deficit of $543 million, largely due to Konfrontasi-related spending. And so he sought to raise an extra $147 million to help cover the gap. On the 25th of November, he unveiled his budget, and it was highly controversial. It included a turnover tax and a payroll tax, both highly regressive. It attracted heated criticism, particularly from Singapore. Coming after the brunt of Indonesia's economic confrontation, the riots in July and September, and the loss of barter trade, the imposition of a turnover tax at 0.5% per annum would fall especially hard on a merchant community like Singapore, where so many operated to extremely fine margins and relied on a high turnover for their profits. The proposed 2% payroll tax would discourage employment, lead to retrenchments, and adversely affect labour-intensive industries. New taxes on diesel oil and sugar were also introduced, in Singapore's case for the first time. Tan also raised the possibility that Singapore's contribution to federal funds would be raised from 40% to 60% of its revenue. Yet, the budget also included plans to reduce the rate of income tax for highest earners from 55% to 50%. At the same time, pressure was exerted on Singapore to fall in line with Malaysia's boycott of South African imports, which of course was a moral stance but not necessarily a sound economic stance. In addition, Tan Siew Sin later announced that the Bank of China branch in Singapore would be closed, a move which the PAP was particularly upset about as it would affect their trade with China. If you've been listening carefully to the last two episodes, the ensuing conflict takes very familiar contours. The issues change, but the way the two sides act and respond and the incentives which shape how they respond had not changed. Lee aggressively stood up for Singapore's interests, saying, "We're not going to let KL push us around." While the federal government said, "We have to take into account Malaysia's national interests as a whole." And given the history between the two sides, there was no incentive for each side to trust each other. In Singapore, the NCUC announced a massive rally of workers at the National Theatre to protest the budget. The police, on the advice of the federal government, denied the rally a permit, so NCUC altered it to an indoor, quote-unquote, delegates conference at the Victoria Memorial Hall, and they dared the police to interfere. Wonder why NTUC don't do that anymore. By December 1964, intergovernmental cooperation between the Singapore and federal government had seriously deteriorated. Looking back, Tan Siew Sin likened it to a married couple whose relationship was so sour that they could not even agree on who should use the bathroom first. On the 9th of December, the Tunku told the Singapore audience that adverse political activity was disrupting peace in Malaysia. And he said, quote, "If the politicians of various colours and tinges in Singapore disagree with me, the only solution is a breakaway. But what a calamity that would be for Singapore and Malaysia." Unquote. And there you have it. It's around this time that a constitutional rearrangement begins to be discussed seriously on both sides. So, separation was not a bolt from the blue. It was a long drawn-out discussion that started roughly around December 1964. Because negotiations took place in secret, it seemed like a bolt from the blue for the public. but it wasn't. I'm going to summarize the discussion here, but I want to emphasize that there's a lot I'm leaving out. It was a very complex issue with a lot of twists and turns, but the important point is it was never inevitable. All the way until the very last few days, either side could have backed away from the edge. So the basic initial proposal from KL was not separation, but a looser constitutional rearrangement that would be de facto separation while retaining a common umbrella of Malaysia. Singapore would revert to self-government. Only defence and foreign relations would be retained by KL. Singapore would have complete autonomy and would give up all seats in the federal parliament. Both sides would close their party branches on the other side of the causeway, and a detailed agreement would be drawn up for a common market. So basically, Singapore reverts to its status between 59 and 63, except now it has control over its internal security and is now basically a colony of KL instead of London. Lee Kuan Yew's counter-proposal was all of the above, except Singapore would retain its seats in the parliament, but abstain from using them for controversial purposes or attacking the federal government. If they did, the federal government could withdraw the self-governing powers of Singapore. Now, these two positions evolved over the ensuing months and they slowly got closer and closer. Lee and Goh Keng Swee and the Tunku and Razak may have come to an agreement, but here, the British stepped in. The British were opposed to any change of the status quo. The action would encourage the idea that Malaysia was breaking up, both internally and externally. It would weaken the British ability to defend Malaysia. It would reinforce criticisms of Malaysia as a neo-colonial construct, giving heart to Sukarno, and encourage confrontasi, and weakening international resolve to defend Malaysia. Internally, it would also discourage national integration. You cannot create a country with two separate parts. There is one country or there is no country. Any loosening of ties could even encourage the Borneo states to pull away, creating a centrifugal effect of breaking up Malaysia and forcing the British to reimpose colonial rule on Borneo. The cost would be unthinkable. It would jeopardize the entire British strategy throughout Southeast Asia, Australia, New Zealand, and in particular, their defense against China. And so the British exerted every bit of leverage they could to oppose any change to the status quo. And they weren't alone. Singapore UMNO got wind of the talks and were furious about the possibility of being abandoned in Singapore. Tan Siew Sin threatened to resign if Singapore were given any financial autonomy, arguing that Singapore had to be fully integrated into Malaysia for the state to function properly. It was, he said, all or nothing, but no halfway house. Dr. Ismail, Minister for Internal Security, wanted the federal government to maintain control of internal security in Singapore, in case something went wrong. And of course, the governments of Australia and New Zealand backed up the British position to the hilt. So, by 4th of March 1965, British High Commissioner Lord Hyde was able to report to London with some satisfaction that any deal was dead. But he also reported that relations between Singapore and KL remained extremely poor and were unlikely to improve. At the same time, it was not merely British and internal pressure that dissuaded the Tunku. A secret report reached him on 12th of February, which described Lee meeting with opposition politicians throughout Malaysia, including Sabah and Sarawak, to form a united opposition. This news upset the Tunku and closed his mind to any deal with Lee. Razak was angry at what he saw as bad faith that they, quote, could not hand over internal security to a man who was operating in this kind of way while in the middle of negotiations with the Tunku, unquote. At the same time, KL was not blameless. It too was actively breaking the truce by reorganizing the Singapore Alliance to defeat the PAP in Singapore. From its perspective, of course, it was not breaking the truce, it was building a national party which was essential for Malaysia. Again, of course, that was not how things were perceived in Singapore. So, as I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, the PAP had decided that entering government with UMNO was no longer feasible. at its annual party conference in November 1964, it resolved to seek not just national influence, but national power on a platform of non-communalism and socialism. To do so, it would go into full-fledged opposition. Instead of playing down differences with the alliance, it would now call attention to those differences and seek to unite all like-minded parties throughout Malaysia on a common platform. Does this sound familiar? Yes, this is exactly what UMNO had feared back in 1961 as the reason why they did not want merger. On the 3rd of March 1965, the opposition grouping was formally announced. And on the 5th of March, Lee Kuan Yew for the first time used the words Malaysian Malaysia. He shortly after left for a two-week tour of Australia and New Zealand, where reports flowed back to Singapore of Lee's remarks attacking the alliance and the central government, causing great anger in KL. You can argue in the family, but you don't air your dirty laundry in public. But worse, in a public interview on television, Lee used explicitly racialist terms in discussing Chinese and Malay society. One, he said, was, quote, a product of a civilization which has gone through all its ups and downs. The other, a people of warm sunshine and bananas and coconuts, unquote. Thus, he said, one was, quote, a high revolution engine and the other, a low revolution engine. Now, these ideas you were suggesting were not in itself controversial in 1965. It was a different time. But by discussing the problem in racialist terms, Lee was betraying his claim to reject communal politics and seek a non-communal Malaysia. And meanwhile, of course, UMNO and the Utusan Melayu were keeping up their barrage of criticism and abuse. Syed Jaafar Albar accused Lee of causing the Singapore riots and of being a communist agent out to, quote, destroy Malaysia and pit Malays and Chinese against each other, unquote. Lee called him a rabble-rouser and the hatchet man of the UMNO leaders hostile to Singapore and sued Syed Jaafar and the Utusan Melayu for libel. Rather belatedly, the federal government appointed a commission of inquiry into the riots. Hearings began in April 1965, but behind closed doors. The findings of the commission have never been revealed to the public. And the same month, the four separate alliance parties in the former federation, Singapore, Sabah and Sarawak, officially merged to form a national alliance party. So despite everything, at this point, there could still have been a halt to all the recriminations and inflammatory rhetoric. We could still have all backed away from the edge and just chilled out. But I'm afraid this is where Lee Kuan Yew hits his nadir. For all his actions before and after Malaysia, you can still argue that he displayed political skill and understanding of power. But in the summer of 1965, May, June, July, he was utterly politically incompetent. He destroyed himself, and he had no one else to blame. And the turning point, I think, is the 4th of May. On that day, he made a controversial speech to the PAP party cadres. In a pseudo-academic vein, Lee examined the pattern of Malay migration and concluded that none of the three races in Malaysia could claim to be more native than any other because all their ancestors came to Malaysia not more than 1,000 years ago. He argued, therefore, that Malaysian rights had to be based on shared citizenship, not birthright or indigeneity. But this speech was a clear and deliberate attack on the most sacred belief underpinning Malay identity, that they were the indigenous people of Malaya, that Malaya was their homeland. And on these beliefs rested their claim to special privileges and Bahasa as the national language. Whether or not Lee was right or wrong is irrelevant, because to bring this up at a time of such great racial tension was a petrol bomb on a raging inferno. It's an act of utter political stupidity, utter folly, utter irresponsibility. It was extremely poor political tactics. And indeed, because it's technically an attack on the Constitution, it's arguably seditious. People have been detained under the Internal Security Act for less than what Lee was saying. And the only reason he wasn't, I believe, is because doing so would have destroyed Malaysia's international reputation, and especially Malaysia's relationship with Britain and its Commonwealth allies, and undermined Malaysian defence against confrontasi. So for the third time in his career, after 56 and 63, Lee Kuan Yew was saved by the British. Now, Lee was possibly trying to antagonise the extremists within UMNO and force the moderate leadership to choose between their principles and their supporters. But the tactic had not really worked against the Barisan in 1961 and 63, and anyway then Lee was working from a position of strength. In Malaysia, he was in a far, far weaker position, and he did not understand the situation. The UMNO leaders faced with a choice between, on the one hand, their community, their voters, their people, their constitution, their country, their bangsa. And on the other hand, Lee Kuan Yew, a man they regarded as scheming and untrustworthy. Was it really a choice between the two? No. What they would do was clear. So it's no surprise then that the UMNO leaders, short of the Tunku himself, attacked Lee's words. Minister for Information, Senu bin Abdul Rahman, for example, attacked Lee for, quote, humiliating the Malays, unquote. Abdul Razak condemned Lee's, quote, mischievous and dangerous remarks, unquote. And battle lines were further drawn on the 8th of May with the formal establishment of the Malaysian Solidarity Convention under the slogan, A Democratic Malaysian Malaysia, calling for an end to communal politics. This timing was unfortunate, for it was followed on the 15th of May by the 18th UMNO General Assembly, where speaker after speaker condemned Lee Kuan Yew and demanded his arrest. The Tunku and Dr. Ismail struggled to keep a lid on the situation, and while condemning Lee's remarks, also reminded delegates that they had to act constitutionally. Dr. Ismail in particular reminded delegates that Lee had confined his attacks to speeches, and thus they should respond in the same manner, not with force. But a motion demanding Lee's arrest was passed unanimously. It was clear to observers that the moderate UMNO leaders, specifically the Tunku and Dr. Ismail, were in a tiny minority, and that they were not strong enough to rid their party of extremists. Jek Yen Tong, for example, who was then Singapore's Minister for Labour, worried over how the extremists were just, quote, winning more and more grassroots support, unquote. He was extremely worried that Lee would be detained. But Lee himself, when asked by the Australian ambassador in Laos, simply shrugged it off. Ismail would act constitutionally, he said. He, quote, had no worry about Ismail, who knew him and understood him very well, unquote. Lee didn't seem to get that with his every public utterance. He was making it harder for the Tunku and Ismail to keep control. That the choice he was forcing on them was not between their principles and supporting extremists, but retaining some control over the extremists or letting the extremists totally take over. On his return from a two-week tour of Asia on the 21st of May, Lee Kuan Yew hit rock bottom and then kept digging. Lee declared, quote, if we must make trouble, let us have it now instead of waiting for another 5 or 10 years. If we find Malaysia cannot work, then we must make alternative arrangements, unquote. Lee's meaning of alternative arrangements became clear the next day when he said that the Malaysian Solidarity Convention wanted to rewrite the constitution to have the fundamental Malaysian Malaysia concept written in. As if that was not enough, he added that the protection of Malay rights was not a fundamental provision of the constitution. Could there be anything more guaranteed to cause outrage? But 2 days after that, Lee snapped and he said, let us be frank. Why should we go back to old Singapore and once again reduce the non-Malays in Malaya to a minority? And I think this was really a fatal error. In belligerently speaking on clear racialist terms, he had betrayed his attempt to present himself as post-racial and confirmed what the Malay extremists all believed, that he was a Chinese chauvinist. See, Lee did not or would not realize a simple truth, that because of all his rhetoric, in the eyes of the alliance, he was seen as much of an extremist as Syed Jaafar Albar. As one contemporary put it, the alliance saw him as much a Chinese ultra as he saw Syed Jaafar as a Malay ultra. Passions reached a crescendo when the federal government opened on 25th May. An UMNO backbencher, the MP for Kota Star Selatan, a man named Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, launched a tirade against the PAP, accusing the party of being, quote, pro-communist and positively anti-Malay, unquote. Lee Kuan Yew moved a motion to censure the Yang Dipertuan Agong's speech, the first time such an occurrence had happened since independence. He gave an electric performance in what was to be his final speech in the Malaysian parliament, speaking for an hour without notes in fluent Malay to lash out against the central government's policy. An editorial in the Straits Times labelled Lee, quote-unquote, reckless. UMNO extremists demanded the arrest of Lee and other PAP ministers. UMNO youth burned an effigy of the Singapore Prime Minister and they marched through the streets with banners proclaiming, in Malay, arrest Lee Kuan Yew, crush Lee Kuan Yew. Later that week, on Sunday 30th May, Lee dropped yet another bombshell when he suggested that Singapore, Sabah and Sarawak would secede and seek to convince Penang, Malacca and maybe even Johor to come with them. He did not use the word partition, but that was what he implied. Lee had actively advocated splitting the country in two. How do you come back from that? And privately, the British High Commissioner, Lord Head, privately called him rash. And rash it was. In Parliament the next day, the entire alliance heaped scorn and anger on Lee. Shouts of, traitor, sit down, get out, and shame rang out in the house when Lee tried to speak. Minister after minister denounced him, including, for the first time, Dr. Ismail. And the Tunku? Well, with great difficulty, he forced himself to sit and say nothing in Parliament. Nothing could be said. Nothing could be done. He was in a no-win situation. So, publicly, he forced himself to be silent. The last leader on either side in this battle who behaved with restraint and responsibility. Someone had to be the adult in the room. Privately, he was frustrated. He was sad. He was anxious. He was completely disillusioned. By this point, it seemed impossible to all observers that Lee and the alliance leadership could be reconciled. Lee had been too provocative, too reckless, openly anti-Malay, had caused too much anger. Deliberately or otherwise, he had burned all his bridges. The British, through Lord Head, the British High Commissioner, tried desperately to find a way for reconciliation, but he found both the Tunku and Lee just rejecting the possibility. The Tunku, quote, did not trust Lee a yard and was completely disillusioned about him, unquote. Lee, in turn, was in a defiant mood, eager to confront a Malay-dominated Malaysia. It looked likely that he would be arrested. Head wrote to London, quote, we are now confronted with a serious crisis, unquote. And the British government warned Tunku Abdul Rahman against removing Lee by force. Why did Lee behave this way? Why did he back everyone, including himself, into a corner from which there was no escape? Surely a politician of his intelligence and ability should have known that, regardless of the truth of what he was saying, what he was demanding was politically impossible. Lee has been so politically flexible over the years. He's been on both sides of nearly every issue. He's been for and against democracy, for and against eugenics, for and against socialism. And whether or not you agree with what Lee was saying in May 1965, and honestly, I think there were many people who did agree with what he was saying in May 1965, it should have been clear that his scorched earth tactics were futile. It was just the wrong time, the wrong place. It was utter political stupidity. It could have been ended if he just apologized or even just kept silent. Because, you know, that's politics. You can't win today. You try again after the next election. Circumstances change, governments change, so you try again after the next election. But Lee just could not leave it. He just kept digging himself deeper and deeper and deeper. And so for all that Lee's reputation is built upon being a master politician, and certainly there are many instances of such in the history of Singapore, in the summer of 1965, he was utterly politically inept. And it was only years later that another truth was revealed. During the summer of 65, Lee was frustrated and exhausted and mentally at his wit's end. And his colleagues later revealed that in this period, Lee was dangerously dependent on drugs. He needed tranquilizers, sedatives, and pep pills to help him sleep, to wake him up, and to get him through the day. The stress of this period took its toll on Lee in highly visible and destructive ways. One moment, he would be smiling, offering the Tunku a brittle picture of acceptance. The next, when he was near people with whom he could relax, such as close friends and colleagues, he would burst into tears or pour forth a torrent of emotion-laden words, recollections, and predictions. But most destructively, he found it increasingly difficult to exercise self-control in front of a microphone. And because of this, made increasingly outrageous and inflammatory speeches, which, though Chin Chai later admitted, were anti-Malay. Indeed, Lim Kim San, years later, was asked in an interview whether they had tried to get Lee to tone down his speeches, and Lim replied, quote, "Oh yes, we did. But once he got onto the podium in front of the crowd, pah, everything will come out. Exactly what we told him not to say, he would say." Unquote. Following separation, Lee would have a breakdown and retreat to a government chalet in Changi and stay there for 6 weeks while he recuperated. As a result, even though separation happened in August, Parliament would not meet until December 1965. So in this light then, Lee's tears on 9th August 1965 are not really a surprise. His fragile emotional and mental state led him to make colossal errors. The events of May 1965 made it impossible for both Malaysia and Lee Kuan Yew to survive. Either Singapore had to leave or Lee had to leave. But even at this late stage, Malaysia could still have survived intact. But of course it didn't. Join us next week for the conclusion to this story and to this series. And don't forget, a live Q&A where I'll be in the studio at 3:30 p.m. on 7th October after episode 49. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week.